I'm concerned about children being given medication and diagnostic labels that will then fix in their mind that somehow they're fragile and they have a permanent handicap. So there are so many cases I know of where 1 year the student's teacher says, hey, he really has ADHD, he needs to get evaluated. The next year, the teacher's like, he is perfectly fine. Like there's no problem here. So it is such a tricky business. And it's I hope that parents have a lot of common sense and, if needed, a reliable expert that can help them to make these decisions. But I think we have to have a really high bar in giving diagnoses and medication. Some will meet that, but I don't think, I'm not sure that everyone would meet that. For the most part, there's just so much damage that can be done, especially with labels.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optumwork.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optumwork.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, good to be back here with you again.
Hey, Sharif. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, of course. I'm glad we could make it happen. Well, Kevin, I thought we could discuss a recent book. As I understand, it's the current number one bestseller on Amazon. It's called Bad Therapy by Abigail Schreier. And she has various critiques of modern therapy, especially relating to the raising of children. And so I'd like to get your thoughts on that book. How's that sound?
Yeah. I read it right when it came out because I was having people asking me about it. So somehow this book made a real splash. And I'll just say right from the get-go, I think she has a pretty captivating writing style. It's so incisive and funny. The chapter titles, the way she, even when she's going after people I like and criticizing them, I think somewhat unfairly, it's really enjoyable to read. So,
and she's not a psychiatrist or a therapist. Right? She's a lawyer by training.
Yeah, and you can tell she's kind of arguing a position and presenting the evidence the way that a lawyer would. And so it's good to know that this is not a book written by a psychologist or a psychiatrist. It's a book written by essentially a concerned parent. She's raising three kids, trying to raise them in a traditional way. Her family is Jewish and seems very devout. So that's where she's coming from, is like, how do you raise children today, particularly if they're going to public schools? Now, her kids go to a Jewish school, but particularly if kids are going to a public school, what are they running into there? And then what she presents is like this this kind of therapy enterprise. Like there's this massive, everything has been turned into therapy. Schools are therapeutic, their counselors are therapists, they're sending people all the time to therapists. And what's this doing to kids? That's the concern that she's bringing to this.
So is this a relatively recent development? The idea of, therapy for children becoming much more common and embedded into mm-hmm. the school system, because I had none of that, when I was growing up. So is this what's behind this, do you think?
Yeah, I think that now I think the estimates are 40%, of students by the time they get to be 18 will have been in therapy at some point. And it's hard to know exactly what that means. And that's one of the difficulties with this topic. Does that mean that they were talking to a school counselor who wasn't officially a therapist because they don't really have the therapy relationship? Were they going outside of that to see someone? So that's what to me is very unclear. So her concern is essentially, are children showing signs of increased emotional health or resilience as a result of going to all this therapy and as a result of bringing more emotional awareness and suicide prevention measures into schools. So that's what she's asking.
Okay. And I'm guessing, given the title of the book, Bad Therapy, she's going to answer that. I think I know how she's going to answer that.
Yeah, she's going to answer that, no. And so she thinks that, in fact, this is making at least many worse. Now, to her credit, she's probably spoken to like 1,000 parents who have had the children had bad experiences. And so that's also where she's coming from, is she did a lot of interviews. And so if you interview people of like, hey, have you had bad experiences with therapy? You're going to get a lot of people responding. I have no idea how she found the people to interview. And I think a lot of it was just parents reaching out to her. And so it's hard to say exactly. I mean, so certainly there's a bias that this is a book to read. If you thought that therapy for kids is just an unalloyed good, well, reading this book would probably get you past that point of view. So, and I think it's a really, there is a valuable message that every treatment can have potential side effects. You know, there can be harm. And I think that the, you know, she compares it to chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is great. Chemotherapy is life-saving. But we wouldn't want to give chemotherapy to everyone. You know, that you're gonna have more harm than good. And if you were going to give it to everyone, you should at least be telling them what the possible side effects could be. And that in most cases, there's no discussion with parents or kids about potential harms of therapy. And there's no real game plan for ending therapy. So the experience that most parents seem to have, and this is, I have to say, according to her, I'm not as familiar with this, is that when their children go to therapy, it's just meant to be an ongoing service that will now be provided. It's really hard to hear about therapists telling the children, you're perfectly well now. You can stop coming to me. And she says that there's every incentive for them to keep the mildly anxious around forever in their practice, because then you don't have to deal with the really sick people. And I know that that is a real risk in any kind of therapist practice, that you become shy about taking on tough cases, and you just get, and your practice could fill with people who are basically well. And that's a much easier lifestyle for a therapist. As someone who does therapy, I completely agree with that. I think it takes a lot of fortitude for therapists to now help people to say, you know what, you're doing well. What I typically do is I just ask people to space out further and further and further. So we don't ever, almost ever, do I, you know, I don't really end it definitively, except in the rare cases when I do deal with younger people. And in that case, my normal thing, and actually I had just done this the week before I read her book. I saw a 17-year-old and, you know, a wonderful girl. And I said, I'll do 6 sessions. You know, and I'm not going to provide any diagnosis. I let them know up front, I am not going to provide a diagnosis. I'm not going to provide medication. You know, but I'll do more than therapy. I said it's not really therapy. I'm happy to be like an educator and a consultant. You know, but that, and we'll just, we can space these 6 sessions out as much as you would like. That's, I think for younger people, I think that's an important way. And then you have to stay also talking to the parents so that they have a sense of what you're doing and how things are helping and what the plan is, so that everyone's kind of on the same page.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
So she's raising the question in particular with children, but then you also brought up, well, actually the same thing is relevant when treating adults, that there can be a tendency mm-hmm. or a temptation to want to take on people who are like mildly anxious and then just keep them coming back. It's kind of a good business model, I suppose, if you want to put it crudely. But is there any
well, that's like the way she puts it? Yeah.
Okay, that's how she yeah. puts it. Yeah. So is is there any special danger of that like applied to children? Is there any difference there, or is it
so? Yeah, what she gives the example of her own therapy, where at some point the therapist suggested that, I think it was, maybe she shouldn't marry her husband yet. Maybe she needs more time. And she could respectfully disagree and then say, I think we're done for now. Well, that, and there's actually Coleman Hughes interviewed her. It's a great interview. And he talks about his own case in therapy where the therapist at some point suggested that he had PTSD from his mother's death. And he said, no, I don't think it's PTSD. I'm grieving, but I don't think it's that. Okay, so that's what adults do in therapy. They don't take the therapist's word as the truth that now is going to define them forever. When a diagnosis comes that they don't agree with or advice comes they don't agree with, they can just say, look, I'm not with you on that. But it's really true that children don't do that. So if you tell a child that they have PTSD, how could a child possibly say, I don't think that's right? They just can't, right? So you, and if, or if you just say, look, I really think that you need to, I don't know, this is how you should handle your parents. This is what you should do. Children don't really, it's the power differential is so great. And the two areas where she's concerned and I'm concerned is that there's no way a child, if a psychiatrist tells them that they need to take a medication for ADHD, would any child say no to that? You know, and I just don't see it. And, or if they apply a label, like, you know, I think that what is happening is really this. I think that there's a lot of mischief that can be worked with the labeling and diagnosing. And I remember having people come to my practice. I have to say, most of the people who come to my practice who have had therapy before have reported that they had a great experience in therapy. I asked them to rate on a scale of 1 to 10, how helpful it was. The most common answer is like 7 or 8. Occasionally it's like a 4, almost never less than that. But that's rare even. Most people have a good experience with therapy in my practice, which is hundreds of people, not maybe, I don't know, thousands, and that probably not getting into thousands, but it's a lot of people, and it's, you know, and it's a nice little cross-section that I have. But anyway, I'm concerned about children being given medication and diagnostic labels that will then fix in their mind that somehow they're fragile and they have a permanent handicap. So and there are so many cases I know of where 1 year the student's teacher says, hey, he really has ADHD. He needs to get evaluated. The next year, the teacher's like, he is perfectly fine. Like there's no problem here. So it is such a tricky business. And it's I hope that parents have a lot of common sense and, if needed, a reliable expert that can help them to make these decisions. But I think we have to have a really high bar in giving diagnoses and medication. Some will meet that, but I don't think, I'm not sure that everyone would meet that. For the most part, there's just so much damage that can be done, especially with labels.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, because she doesn't say that all therapy is bad therapy or that it's all equally bad. So I guess I have a just kind of question about, your area of expertise, CBT, what you were trained in. Was there a sense as you were, kind of coming up as a psychiatrist that you were, or there was an option to be trained in therapy for adolescents, or is this a totally new thing? And then kind of related to that, is your sense that most of the therapy that's given to children is CBT or is not CBT, or what's the landscape? I don't know if you could.
I can't really speak right now to the landscape. When I was in training, there were the people with the most prestige in the training program for children seemed to be the child analysts, the child psychoanalysts. And I don't really remember there being child CBT people. But this was, you know, I only had a few months of exposure to that world, maybe 6 months total. But that was my recollection. I think that things have changed and now there's a lot more CBT offered. And just for the record, she is totally positive about CBT. So she is totally positive about exposure therapy. And she thinks that CBT is still like the first line treatment when you have really serious problems. So for very significant problems. Now, it's a weakness in the book, and it's just because she's not an expert. She can't really tell you the difference between a profound mental health problem and the kind of knock it off, shake it off kind of problem. And so that's because she's just not an expert in this. So all she can do is gesture that there is a group of people that would be really helped by CBT. And then there's a lot of people getting bad therapy. So that's kind of what she thinks is that, and it is her experience mirrors mine, that most people who say they do CBT don't really do CBT. And so people, it's very common that, you know, when in psychology today in their profile or on their website, they say they do CBT, or they say they do IFS, or they say they do ACT or DBT, and they just don't do it at all. In the end, it becomes very commonly, and this is what she's really concerned about, what we call co-rumination, that you just have someone to ruminate in front of. And it's kind of complaining and rehashing, you know, and then even when people are starting to feel better, they're like, well, let's go back to the problems you had with your mom, you know, and let's, so the idea is like, they just, because it's kind of the business model is like, you just keep talking about the problems. And then, so her concern is co-rumination a real issue? And I think it is. Yeah, and I do think that whether it's in a social group or a therapeutic setting, if all they're doing is dwelling on the negative and you don't get a sense that there's a forward movement, and what that would look like is that there is some degree of validation of the problem, and then the therapist is kind of helping the person to be more confident in approaching this in a new way. You know, and so if you don't see that on the part of the therapist, I think it's a concern. So if you're not seeing that there's new strategies, new initiatives, I mean, it really comes down, like Donna Pincus talks about this, these three things that parents need to do. And she's talking about growing up brave, that's the name of her book, and it's how you deal with anxiety in kids. And she says parents are by far the most important intervention. And that's totally right. And Donna Pincus is classic CBT. She's the head of the Boston University Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders for Children. So she says that parents need three things. One, validate the anxiety. Let them know that you understand that they're feeling it. Two, show total confidence that they can get through this. And then three, and most important, no accommodation. You don't give in. You don't let them. And I think that Abigail Schreier would love that approach if she knew about it. She would be totally on board, and that would actually meet a need that the book has, which it doesn't have much positive direction. Like, what do you do now? We've said that there's all these bad things that can happen in therapy, which we kind of knew already. Then what's the next thing? I think that actually Donna Pincus, that kind of strategy, parent-child interactive therapy, is a wonderful direction to go. And has a lot of research behind it.
Now, Kevin, this might be a little bit harsh, but as you were talking about the co-rumination, I mean, it sounds like it's not just a waste of time, but actually they're reinforcing vicious cycles there. I mean, is that right? So it's actually harmful. It's not just kind of neutral, not really doing anything. It's actually doing the opposite of what therapy should be. It's actually.
And I think parents should be a little bit skeptical. If the whole kind of business model depends on the therapist uncovering and then discussing pain points with no end in sight, there could be real problems with that. You would hope then that the people involved would be setting limits to say, you know, this is what I do, you know, many times is, not just with young people, but even with others, I'll say, you know what, I'll give you 6 sessions and then we'll just reevaluate. especially if people come to me with issues that I haven't really mastered myself. Like there are things where it could be a kind of a rarer thing that is happening to them. And it's going to take some exploration to see, am I able to actually make a difference here? But I'll say, okay, 6 sessions. And I've actually had people get fantastic results within the time frame. You know, and so, and I don't know if we would have had the same fantastic results. It was going to be endless therapy. So I found that it can be really helpful to set a limit to the number of sessions, particularly if you're not totally sure if this is your expertise right now. I would hope that therapists in general would do that.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of related, but one of the ideas she brings up is the treatment prevalence paradox. So I wonder if you could explain what that is and how it fits in.
Yeah, so this is the most serious, you could say rigorous, intellectual aspect of the book. And it has to do with this question of, if we're treating more and more people for depression, or it could be anxiety, why is the prevalence of depression not going down? So wouldn't you expect, with all this treatment that we're doing, that in fact it would get better? So Hans Hormel is a Dutch psychiatrist who has the best stuff on this. So if people want to they can look up Hans, or Johan is sometimes how his first name is said, Johan Hormel. And this actually gets to the heart of the issue in some sense. What's going on with the fact that depression rates are rising, even though treatment is rising? So you have more treatment, but more prevalence. That's the paradox. And one reason could be that, in fact, people who aren't really sick are being diagnosed now as sick. So they have the blues, but it's called depression. And so could that be what's going on? That we're now diagnosing a lot more people, and maybe not that rigorously. And Hans Hormel says that no, that we have evidence now that that's not the case, because we've done a lot of good structured clinical interviews, you know, as part of these epidemiological studies. So it's not simply that more people are being diagnosed, and so that's offsetting the treatment gains. Is it just that the how else do you explain it?
Mm-hmm. One thought that I had, I mean, there might be underlying social factors, for instance, social media, that's causing increased levels of depression.
Yeah. So the question is then, you know, is the actual incidence of these things going up? I think that's still a little bit left to be answered. So there's not like an airtight case one way or another. What Hormel actually suggests is that in fact, what's happening is that we don't really have great treatments. That treatments looked good in randomized control trials that were relatively short. But in fact, in the wild, as they say, they're not as effective. Because a lot of times people are just getting antidepressant monotherapy with, you know, maybe it's not like barely adequate treatment. Or they're having therapy, psychotherapy as a treatment, but it's not really like what's been studied. So it's like the issue, you know, someone says they do CBT, but it's not really CBT. If there is an actual study, the people giving the CBT would be really well trained, and they'd be monitored to make sure they're actually delivering according to the model. Well, obviously that doesn't really happen in real life. So when you look at the effect size that we have for treatment, it's actually pretty small. For both antidepressants and psychotherapy. In fact, the effect sizes are like 0.36 and 0.34 or something like that, respectively, which is a very small effect size. So I think that's the issue. You know, and so that, in fact, the treatments we have don't work that well. So we're treating a lot of people, but they're not really getting better.
But there's not necessarily a sense that the treatment is causing the prevalence. Like it's a bad treatment that's actually making the problem worse.
And he suggests that that can be, and that right now that remains a possibility that's open, that in fact the treatment itself is causing the problem. And it's an open question. So people can, you know, can read, there's different meanings for treatment prevalence paradox, but if they look up Hormel, they'll see the way he uses it. if they want to learn more about it, they can. It's all free online access, so they can look it up. It's interesting stuff. We do need better treatments for psychiatric illness in childhood. So, and we need better advice. I think parents need to be more confident that they are really the prime caregivers. And I think this is another important point of the book, which has to be taken into account, which is that parents can't give over the care of their children to experts. They are the experts for their children and what their children need. And so we don't want, and I think this is true, we don't want parents' expertise and their sense of confidence to be undermined. That somehow a problem comes up and they're like, ooh, this is no way I can handle this. You know, that's why I like the Donna Pincus approach so much. You know, that parents can, you know, need to actually buttress their children's confidence by being confident that their kids, in fact, will get through things, that losing is good for them, that the ordinary response to bad things happening in life is resilience, and that they learn to get back up and to keep going. So I think that sense is actually a really important one.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just briefly talk about reframing in the context of parenting, because, you know, I think parents could be so attached to their own child's, you know, flourishing and development and success that they mm-hmm. think, okay, if I make some mistake parenting, it's going to, you know, cause like irreversible harm to the child or something. But parents should have kind of a growth mindset when it comes to their own ways of treating their children and trying to improve, develop new strategies in parenting, reframing these little setbacks, right?
Yeah. Now, this goes back to what we talked about once with about Daniel Siegel. So in the book, No Drama Discipline, you know, and I think he gets it totally right. He says that the discipline challenges with kids are actually opportunities to be teaching them. So that you always want to see, how can this incident help my child to develop more into a caring, reliable adult? And that's exactly right. And also then second, like underlying that, how can this ultimately build our bond more strong? So we have a stronger bond as a result of this. It's one of the weaknesses, unfortunately, of Schreier is that once she starts firing at people, it's hard for her. There's a lot of friendly fire. And so she ends up being kind of, in a very funny way, critical of Dan Siegel, you know, because she explains, she quotes him out of, maybe unfairly, you know, as if he's presenting parents as morons, and that really what parents, that's how she puts it, and that really what parents need is more neuroscience, that parents just don't understand enough neuroscience. And then her rejoinder is, neuroscientists also need more neuroscience. There's a lot of bad neuroscience out there, and there's a lot we don't know. Okay, all that's true. But Dan Siegel, I think, is on the right side of all of this. And if she could appreciate him, I think. You know, that this idea that discipline is about teaching, that's the reframe. How are you shaping your children? Are you helping them to become the kind of person that you want, that you think that they ought to become? What is the deeper tradition in your family that will be the pattern? Because then when there are problems, they become a way of showing them what we aspire to in our family, that this is what we hold sacred. And so, you know, we hold other people and their interests also as sacred. We hold generosity as sacred. And we try to be generous with the poor and with others in our life. So we try to be detached from our own, you know, what we own. So in fact, reframing is always about putting things in a wider context so you can see the opportunity for growth there. But the tradition of the family, particularly the faith of the family, is the wider context for reframing. And I think so discipline ultimately is, Dan Siegel's right, it's for teaching, but really it's for making disciples. The point of it is discipling. That's really what it means. And so, and that means raising people in a tradition, you know, that the parents can ask themselves, what's the best that our family has to offer our children? What are really the best traditions that our family has? those that we pass those on to the children, I think that, and the moral tradition of the family and the beliefs of the family, that's the most precious thing. Often, if people look at where that tradition came from in their family, they'd actually see it goes back thousands of years. You know, this is a long process that was passed on, you know, and then it's the job of the parents to pass it on to the next generation. And all the ups and downs that happen with disciplining and stuff have to be seen in that broader context. If you were to discipline children in a way that alienated them from the family traditions, I think that's a problem. And you'd have to find another way of doing it, a better way of doing it. And I think it would always be a more loving way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, hey, Kevin, we're out of time. Thanks so much for taking all these questions.
All right, Sharif. Thanks for the questions, as always.
Okay. All right. We'll be back next week. Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.